They do deals with their friends, and they do, and a lot of time they do terrible deals because it's a relationship-based business. And Zaz didn't seem to care about that. He killed off CNN Plus. He did things that you would never do.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Monday, March 18th, which means it's Media Monday. Today, John Kelly and I discuss the bull case for David Zaslav at Warner Brothers Discovery. He's made a lot of people angry over the last 2 years, sure, but is there anyone better for the job of cost-cutting and building for the future at WBD? We also take a look at the mega business of college football and whether certain teams and conferences might ever break away from the feckless NCAA and do things their own way. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Monday, everybody. If it's Monday, it is, of course, Media Monday. I'm joined today by John Kelly. We have recorded this episode before Selection Sunday. So to the selection committee, if you picked Cincinnati to go to the tournament, good job. If you didn't, you suck. John, you're in California this week. It's good to see you in my state. I hope you enjoyed the little Puck get-together at Bill Cohan's East Side LA vacation home this week. How was it? I'm sorry I had to miss it.
Well, first of all, I'm at the vestigial Warshaw Hamby home here in Ojai. We're going to walk by the tree under which you were married about 10 months ago. There's a little plaque there commemorating it. And it's, you know, obviously for us East Coast people, it's great to be in California this time of year. And I wouldn't quite call Bill's Hancock Park mansion, you know, one of like 17 that the guy has. I don't know how he makes sure that they're all insured. East Side, it was beautiful, very modern and a useful. We missed you, but it was a lot of fun, but actually a useful lead into our first segment because we were discussing the Zaz of it all, and it was a real proper party. You know, a lot of people were guffawing over Susan Orlean, you know, of Orchid Thief fame, but eventually it was the Puck West Coast All-Stars who stayed after Deb Futter, Bill's wife, kicked everyone out, and we were getting into Zaz mania. So that'll be reflected, I think, in some of what we're talking about today.
What else would be discussed at a Puck party?
I don't know.
So yeah, late last week, Bill filed a smart piece sort of outlining, I guess you would say, the bull case for David Zaslav at Warner Brothers Discovery. Yep. And I say the bull case because he's taken so much shit lately by obviously his critics in the creative community in New York and Los Angeles who think he's just like him and Gunner or bean counters who are like killing projects and trying to put Dr. Pimple Popper on TV instead. But you know, he also has this massive job of slashing debt, juicing revenue, figuring out a streaming future. And look, you know, as someone who wrote a friendly piece about Kamala Harris last week, it's important to write a bull case every now and then if there is evidence to support something that deviates from the narrative. So I did want to talk to you about it. First of all, just level set for us, like, what is the torrent of criticism that Zaslav is facing right now before getting into, hey, pump the brakes, everybody. This guy might be the guy to save this company.
Well, yes, no, and I think that there's a lot to unpack here, but here are the key things. So obviously, you know, David Zaslav basically created this company 2 years ago by pulling together the underwhelming Discovery Communications company, which was, you know, controlled by John Malone, his mentor, and Steve Newhouse and the Newhouses through various sort of, you know, deals over the year. You know, that had been a very acquisitive company, and the unloved Warner Media assets out of AT&T. Everyone who listens to the show knows all this, but I'm just saying that it was basically not even a combination or a merger. It was this insane LBO where Zaz got this company with $55 billion in debt, and it was supposed to do, you know, $15 billion in EBITDA, and he was going to continue to reduce the debt and sell things off. But basically, you know what? Let me explain this in a better way, Peter. He was going to deploy Wall Street tactics, LBO tactics, on a creative Hollywood asset. And this gets to the criticism and the outcomes here. And Zaz spent the year before the merger in Hollywood, you know, sort of recasting his image. He bought the Bob Evans house. He was going to redo the commissary at the Warner's lot. And he was really sort of kissing the ring of the creative community. Whenever you read about a pre-Oscars party or some big event, like Zaz was there with Brian Lord or Ari Emanuel, and he really wanted to show that he cared. But in the weeks before the deal closed, almost exactly 2 years ago to the day, it became clear that Zaz wasn't fucking around. And this is what I think made a lot of people, including myself, to put my neck out there, really admire the guy. He had stones. He was going to go into this very, very friendly, creative-based community, an economic ecosystem where people don't just grin fuck. They do deals with their friends, and a lot of time they do terrible deals because it's a relationship based business. And Zaz didn't seem to care about that. He killed off CNN Plus.
He killed Batgirl.
That's right, exactly. Well, he did things that you would never do. I mean, to take a movie that you had every instinct was not going to perform and just kill it. It brutalized sensibilities. And he licensed content, which seemed, you know, also infuriating to people because they wanted HBO assets to only be on HBO. And he disappeared content from the library, meaning he stopped paying. He basically, you know, sort of hit the ejection button on the remainder bin of TV and movie assets because he didn't want to pay these royalties anymore. These were, if you come from the higher calling of private equity, these are no-brainer moves. They are. You're slashing costs. This is the economic equivalent of taking your organization and saying, no more MacBooks. We're going to give you all Acers. You know, you can still do your job just fine. But it was a supernova, a hurricane of agony. And in the weeks and months since, the problem has been that Zaz has cut the cost, right? They've cut $15 billion, him and Gunna, the hatchet man, down to $40 billion in debt. And
not Gunna, who was indicted by Fannie Willis in Georgia for racketeering. Not the rapper Gunna.
No.
Gunnar Wiedenfels, just to be clear, Gunnar for our Wiedenfels. Atlanta rap fans listening to the powers that be.
Totally. I'm sorry. I get confused with my Puck cinematic universe here. And so they were able to cut the debt down to 40. But the challenge they had last year, and we're kind of, you know, thinking back on 2023 as a year to whole, because they had their Q1 meeting not long ago, and they look back, they kept lowering EBITDA guidance. So the problem is they're not making enough money for the company as they cut costs. I think they missed EBITDA by about 30%. And if you look forward, and this is, you know, where the town's head is at, you're saying, hey, you're not going to, there's no Barbie this year. HBO Max, or Max as it's called, is still stuck around 100 million paying subscribers. There's no doubt that Zaz and Gunnar Wiedenfels can continue to cut the debt, but can they grow the revenue? Because that's how an LBO actually pops, right?
Yeah.
You cut costs and you grow the revenue, and then the market reappreciates it. So anyway, that's the backdrop, and you know, Zaz, it makes a fortune. The conversation would all be very different if A, he wasn't trying to create this company so that he could run it rather than sail off into the ghost ship of Discovery Communications, and B, you know, he had a $250 million stock incentivized pay package last year. His bonus is going to get reported. Everyone in town is preying on it because the Schadenfreude is through the roof. I was actually having lunch with a a Jason player into this world not long ago who was, you know, reiterating to me just how every, you know, the dislike is palpable. And so that was the context with which Bill wrote this story. And it was a very unpopular bull case for Zaz. You know, and the idea here is that the, and the headline sort of says it all, is the Zaz correction coming? And Bill, who, as we know, you know, spent 20 years as a banker, did something that I think the media has not done and the agent and producer class has not done, which is he looked at the debt maturities. Mm-hmm. I.e., when the debt comes due. And I've heard murmurs for years from the sort of Zaz inner circle that they have good debt. And, you know, I don't know. I was too busy to really understand what that means. But Bill got into the weeds here and pulled up that, yes, a lot of the debt is due. You know, the notes are due in like 10 years. Now, obviously, there's like a $700 million payment that's due this week. So I'm not saying this is all put off, but there's a $3 billion debt repayment due in 2062. And the bulk of the debt is due between 2030 and 2062.
That's a sensible middle-class 30-year mortgage style debt.
Dude, totally. And that is the point here, that the sword of Damocles over this company's head is not as severe, and the market has not priced that in yet. This is not investment advice. Bill's not offering investment advice, but that's material. There is no jumbo payment due here that will force management to make certain decisions. And second of all, I think as Bill sees it in this piece, and it, again, people should read this. Bill's infinitely smarter than I am on these matters. But there is a real feeling that there is marketing and probably payment optionality with the Max assets. So on the two sides of this LBO, the debt piece is being managed and is not as significant as many in the market have considered. On the revenue piece, Bill's point of view is that don't worry about what the studio's got coming next year and the year after. Focus on the profitable-ish streaming business, because if Zaz can continue to make more, you know, to eke out more profit, either, you know, by cutting costs, which we've seen he knows how to do on this, by disappearing things, by charging more, by growing its audience as Paramount Global, among other things, inevitably fades away, then, and here's the final crescendo, the P/E ratio will improve, and the second part of the LBO alchemy will bang into place. Netflix PE ratio is 50. Netflix is not, WED is not going to get that. But if it gets anywhere in sniffing distance of that, this thing will pop. Stock price is down 60%, something like that, in 2 years. That's dreadful. But once the, in Bill's view, and I appreciate this, once the market understands that there is a path to profitability in the DTC business, then this thing could really, really turn around significantly.
I was struck also in that article that Bill wrote about the, like, the valuation ratio. I mean, there's a better term for this in finance.
PE ratio.
Yeah. Like, price to earnings ratio is 50, meaning that every dollar of earnings that Netflix gets is valued by the market at 50 times that $1. Jesus Christ, Netflix, what a monster. All right, John, thanks for helping me sort through the Zaz bull case. When we come back, our colleague John Orend has some provocative reporting about whether college football might ever pull away from the NCAA as a way to further maximize their already maximal profits. John and I discuss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. We're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome back to the Powers That Be, everybody. It's Media Monday. You know, something that John Kelly and I have talked about for a long time on this podcast is that sports is media. And we finally consummated that theory by hiring John Oren a few months ago, who's been killing it. John, our colleague John from the DMV, wrote a piece late last week about this sort of think tank that's coming together with a bunch of VIPs and like sports adjacent rich people, as well as former athletes who are noodling on the idea of how to make college football better. And this is, I think, if I'm reading this article correctly, not coming from the idea of like, how do we make this better for athletes and like get them paid more and get them benefits, more coming from how do we get even more profits out of the college football behemoth, which if you look at the panorama of college sports is just on a whole nother level compared to college basketball, baseball and everything else in college sports. What did you make of this little think tank? Who's involved and what exactly are they trying to do with college sports?
It's a big scoop from our man John. It's funny. He was so excited when he nailed the detail that Brian Rolapp, who is Roger Goodell's consigliere, was involved in this 20-odd person think tank. He called me on Wednesday night. And it's funny. I was in the hotel we were staying in L.A. The Timberwolves were there for a couple of days. They had a back-to-back against the Lakers and the Clippers. And
yeah, that was a big series.
It was just big series. And by the way, hilarious because our hotel was caught up in the whole WAG scene of it all. And pretty amazing. Watched I saw things, and let me tell you, the little Kelly kids, they saw things too.
Some NBA players have wives and girlfriends. Those aren't separate things if you're some NBA players.
And they're entitled to their private lives. Now, I will take it no further. But this was an unbelievable new element to the scholarship on this. I mean, you nailed it. Like, college sports, the toothpaste is out of the tube. And we're past the era when this patronizing, condescending era when the NCAA said, well, you know, positioned itself as suggesting that they were offering the value of a college education and that alone was enough, which is important, obviously, but is complete and utter baloney when you consider that you're paying these college coaches $10 million and the strength and conditioning coaches are making $1 million because the labor is free, right? I know what paradigms this matches to. They're disgusting. If student athletes are bringing in this much money to a university through the gate and through media rights, then they should absolutely be paid. We chose capitalism. Remember, we did. And they should absolutely be incentivized. And they should absolutely, and this is where the think tank comes into place, they should be able to collectively bargain. They should not be forced to deal with the rules of socialism, which is basically what the NCAA has forced on these revenue-generating sports for a number of years. And I think that we will look back at this era when Caleb Williams, you know, is doing Wendy's ads as being quaint. Like, the next Spanx will, you know, be created by a future Heisman Trophy winner who plays at Oklahoma or something and has more national exposure than Patrick Mahomes, right? Like college sports is enormous. And if you look at the Casey Wassermans and the Jerry Cardinals, they all see a world in which a business that's like $3 or $4 billion can be 10 overnight. So what's this group trying to do? And yes, it's made up of ADs. It's made up of Grant Hill, who's a minority owner in the Orioles, in addition to being a former Duke star and NBA star. And they are, I think, trying to figure out how do you like thread the needle here to allow capitalism to work its course, but to still preserve the sanctity of scholarship that exists here, right? Like, we don't want a world in which the entire ecosystem is two and done in the portal, whether
the portal
it's
sucks,
you know,
man.
The portal is the worst, and you know, I think we don't want a world where these college kids are paying 20 games a season too, you know, because it's all one large draw. But there's no question that economically it doesn't make sense for 10 conferences to bid independently for TV network deals. Imagine what would happen if the Big Ten and SEC and the ACC and the Big 12, which is now the Big Four, and then the other small, you know, mid-majors, WAC, MAC, whatever's left, said, you know, went to the networks the same way the NBA does and says, yeah, we're going to do three deals this year, right? Or five deals. And here are the opportunities that you can bid on, you know, certain conferences, certain time zones. I don't know what it is. I'm not smart enough to configure this. That easily is a, you know, we're talking about $4 or $5 billion a year from each of those guys, right? Like thinking about the national fandoms here, Oklahoma has way more national appeal than the Oklahoma City Thunder. You know, like it's not even close. And I think that we have to lean into this and manage it responsibly. The NCAA is feckless. It's meaningless. It's totally toast. And at its best, this think tank, this group of 20, whatever you want to call it, the G20 of college sports, is putting its best effort forward to make sure that like this process, this transition is responsibly managed, that it doesn't just become a total Wild West, which in other hands it could.
Part of me is very skeptical that whatever this looks like, separatist movement from college football could ever happen, just because the NCAA is so entrenched in our culture and in college athletics. But you know, as John points out, having watched the way the Pac-12 collapsed, having watched how Cal and UCLA just were like, we're out, and like went to SEC and went to the Big 12. Like, if the leadership of a variety of schools and their conferences were literally like, we're out. Like, they do have the money to embark on this sort of thing. As a long shot as it might be, the question for me would be like, okay, if the SEC joins a new sort of college football league that comes up with some way to treat college athletes better while also maximizing profits and doing deals, how does that affect the athletic programs that aren't college football at those schools? Like, if you are LSU football, LSU women's basketball, LSU baseball, LSU volleyball, like those are like really good programs. Like, do they remain in the NCAA? Like, I don't know. It's all like very, very interesting to chew over. I'm sure all the ESPN loudmouth talk show hosts will talk about this in a much more sophisticated way than we are here. But I don't know.
Yeah,
it's a great
scoop. But I bet you're right, though, that you're right that they will have to structure this deal in some way to appease that that concern. I'm making this up. This is all unwritten now, but I assume any deal gets structured in a way that some not meaningful but not de minimis percentage goes towards preserving other sports. Now, I do think certain sports will get dropped at these schools because they're making so much money on college football right now. They're moving towards a world where they're going to make even more money in college football, but they're going to have to spend way more to keep it, right? I mean, look at a 120-person roster. I keep saying University of Oklahoma, but consider that there's going to be much more significant cost to compete to get these kids there. They're going to, you know, the boosters will have to be involved in the local community to make sure that the NIL money is there. If you're a quarterback coming out of high school now, are you going to go play at, you know, Florida or Nebraska? It would seem like a no-brainer, but what if Nebraska can say, hey, the local Ford dealership is going to offer you $4 million a year to do marketing? Like, but that's what they're facing here. And I'm sure that the only way they can make this work is by raising their cost and figuring out a way to at least act as though they're preserving, you know, maybe not like the curling team at the University of Minnesota, but certainly the crew. But you know what this made me think of, Peter? And you'll appreciate this because this is our touchdown for our generation. I started thinking about Chris Webber when I read this story. And if you recall, he was the first athlete, at least that I remember, who, as part of the Fab Five, created a national fashion trend, created a style. I mean, the black sneakers and black pulled up socks, those beautiful gold Michigan uniforms with the long shorts. And, you know, Webber said, I walk around my campus seeing hundreds of kids wearing my jersey, you know, like rubbing coins together to be able to pay for, you know, pizza at the student union. This doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, I think that they erased one or both of the Fab Five's final game appearances because there was some booster who was allegedly connected with them. But in the end, guys like Webber were the ones that really made this happen. Now, I know that's on the basketball side, but they are the ones who pushed forward the idea that we have to be honest. These are not normal students. They work out and train and prepare for hours and hours a day. They're on national television every week. They're no different from a child appearing in a movie or a TV show. Anyway, the NCAA has just been disgusting in all this, and I'm so glad that this is all happening.
Yeah, I should make clear that I am extending unfurling a very long middle finger toward the NCAA while I'm talking about them. The other fascinating thing, too, is like you mentioned, Caleb Williams, the USC quarterback, most likely the number one NFL pick. Like, that dude has made so much money from NIL mm-hmm. deals, like, and he should. But I saw a tweet recently, like, from some other USC fan that was, like, mentioning the fact that, like, Reggie Bush had his Heisman Trophy yep. taken away in 2005 because he received, like, improper benefits. And, like, he must be looking at Caleb Williams, like, living in this, like, beautiful loft apartment, you know, overlooking totally. USC, driving a sick car and being like, what the fuck? Like, that sucks. Yeah. Hey, real quick before I go, I should mention, in John's email, The Varsity, everyone should subscribe, there was a really interesting note about women's college sports. He compared the viewership numbers for the women's Big Ten championship, which obviously starred Caitlin Clark from Iowa, who's a supernova, and the second Duke-UNC game, which is, you know, the marquee basketball matchup in college basketball. Caitlin Clark's Iowa team versus Nebraska registered 3.02 million viewers, almost beat the viewership number for Duke Carolina, which came in at 3.09. And, like, I'm not trying to virtue signal here. Like, I actually like women's college basketball. I've been watching it for years. You know, maybe some of the interest in the sport is flowing out of last year's title game between LSU and Iowa, but, like, partly because of Caitlin Clark, but also just general interest. Like, women's college basketball is becoming, like, kind of a thing. And John sort of makes yeah. note of that in his piece. You know, not that it hasn't always been a thing, but in terms of, like, TV viewership, there really hasn't been a comparison between men's and women's TV numbers. But certain games are starting to get there, and I find that pretty exciting. John, enjoy the Ohio Valley Inn. Get a Pixie Margarita for me and Katie. Thanks for talking, buddy.
All right. See you soon, pal.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.